I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers.
Hey, Jim.
Hey. And let's open this with a moment of silence for the sick and suffering alcoholic, followed by the serenity prayer. Serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And thank you all for coming back and listening to me again and again and again. This is week 8. And I've really enjoyed this. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing this with y'all, and I really appreciate y'all giving me the opportunity to do it here. We are in working with others, and where we stopped, anybody remember? We stopped on page 99. But before we go to that, I want to do a couple things, because this entire chapter, I told you, was Bill talking about the importance of how he's going to stay sober. He's going to stay sober, but he's going to stay sober because he's working with others. All right? And if we go back, just hold your finger on that page. If we go back to page 14 in Bill's story, it says there, my friend emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And if he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed, and with us it was just like that. So Bill, in his story, before he's ever even written the 12 steps, Bill in his story is talking about how the 12 step is going to come about. And he hasn't even written them yet, because we haven't gotten that far yet. Jump over to page 19, and there's a solution. On the bottom of page 19, at the first paragraph, none of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think of its effectiveness would be increased if we did. So they're saying we don't work, make it our sole job to do this. We feel the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And then at the bottom of the page it says, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions or attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon the constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And if we jump back on page 18, there's a solution that says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, the 12 steps, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So, how is Bill already knowing, you know, that working with others is going to be the most important part of this program? Well, it's from Ebby bringing the message to him from the Oxford group. And in the Oxford group, they had 6 steps. And one of their steps was helping others. Now, one of the things that happened, and one of the reasons that they broke apart, is the Oxford group started to have a little conflict with the alcoholics. The alcoholics were really just trying to work with alcoholics that were coming in. And the Oxford groupers were wanting them to do other things, to spread the message, to carry the good news, things like that. And the alcoholics really were just really feeling like they needed to work directly with other alcoholics. And that's where the split came about 38, 39, when Alcoholics Anonymous got formed, because they broke off from the Oxford group. But most of these, the 12 steps, 6 of those steps were from the Oxford group. They were just rewritten by Bill. And then he divided them up a little bit, expanded them a little bit, and made them into 12 steps. And when he got done, he wrote it in about a half hour, I told you, after he prayed for guidance. And when he got done, he noticed that they were numbered 1 to 12, and he thought, 12 steps, 12 disciples, you know, he kind of thought that was good. And I told you that in the beginning, the first 4.5 chapters, how much fighting there was between the first 100 or so when the manuscript was being written. Some of them didn't want God in there at all. Some of them wanted God all over it. Some of them wanted Jesus Christ all over it. And Bill almost quit. He almost threw up his hands and said, I'm just not going to do this anymore unless you let me write the book. And after the chapter 5 was written and rewritten and rewritten, chapter 5 was rewritten 44 times before it finally got approved by everybody, and all the other members agreed that from that point forward, Bill could write the book and he would send them copies of it and they would look at it. But if he wanted to, he would change something, but he wasn't required to. He was in charge of writing the book. And so, in working with others, and we're going to go back and jump over to page 98, start there. And I told you this will probably be the end of me reading line by line, because what we're going to find in a couple of pages is we have read the program of action as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps. And this is the 12th one right here. It's not a matter of giving that's in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. The whole book, the whole time Bill's writing this book, he's trying to lead us to a power greater than ourselves. Not tell us who that power should be, but tell us that we're going to have a power greater than ourselves if we're going to stay sober, and that we're going to have to work with others if we're going to maintain sobriety and keep increasing our spiritual awareness. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn the truth. And what he's saying there is that when they were doing it between 35, when he and Bob met, and then 8 days later they went to Bill Dodson in the sanitarium, all the things that they tried to help alcoholics with for the next 3.5 and 4 years that didn't work, they took some pretty hard knocks. They found out some pretty hard lessons. And so he's saying that they have taken some very hard knocks to learn the truth, that you can't depend on man. You have to depend on the power greater than yourself, the God of your understanding. And he goes on to say, job or no job, wife or no wife, and then you can add anything else, husband or no husband, children or no children. We simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. All right? And then he goes on to tell you, burn the idea into the conscience of every man that he can get well, regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean his house. All right? And when Bob said that the simplest way to look at this program is trust God, clean house, and help others. And that really sums up the 12 steps. Now it goes on, and we're going to get into a couple of domestic things, the domestic problems. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. And he's using himself as an example with Lois, and he's using Dr. Bob and Ann Smith as examples. When your prospect has made such reparations as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put these principles into action at home. That is, if he's lucky enough to have a home. Because there's an awful lot of us that get here, we don't have a home, we don't have a can to do whatever in, we don't have anything. All we have is desperation to get out of the hell that we've created. Nobody created it for us. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like a plague. Remember last week when I said that? You know, arguing and finding fault with the other person when we've already read through here that the troubles of our own making, that our self-centeredness is what caused all this in the beginning, and that drinking really wasn't our problem. It was just a symptom of our problem, of our selfishness and self-centeredness, of our fears. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. We're on page 99, Greg. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover that they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. Instead of argument and fault finding, if we're living on a spiritual basis, then you can have these discussions, as I call them, without getting into arguments. After they have seen tangible results, now, not heard tangible results, we're talking about the family members. After they have seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. Now, what I've learned in the program is that not everybody's going to like me. And that's a sad thing, because I like to be liked. I'm selfish, self-centered, and I like to be liked. I mean, that's the bottom line. But not everybody's going to like me. But I know for a fact, if I didn't do anything to harm you, and I know that my God knows I didn't do anything to harm you, then what you think about me is none of my business. That's on you. And so they're saying right here that as long as he continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anybody says or does. Of course, we all fall much below this standard many times. And how it works, it says we are not saints. You know, we strive for perfection. But I don't know anybody who's ever going to be perfect. I've just never met a perfect person. But I've met a lot of people who strive for perfection. But we always fall a little bit short of the standard that we set for ourselves. But we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by another spree. All right. So if we're sober, we're considerate, we're helpful, we need to stay that way, and we need to repair the damage in our family, you know, immediately. I mean, when he uses words like immediately, at once, he's not wanting you to, you know, stand around and think about it for a long period of time. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. You know, when you're a drunk like me for 30 years, it's going to be real hard for my wife to understand that I'm living on a spiritual basis in 6 months, in a year, in 2 years. It takes time. Time takes time. And that's what Bill's trying to let us know right there. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis, a spiritual basis, I call it, since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is the best interest of all concerned that a couple remain apart. And now he goes on to say, obviously, no rule can be laid down. So they're not telling you, you got to do this, you got to do that. It's how your God's working in your life when you're repairing the damage in your family. Let the alcoholic continue his program, and I call it program of recovery, but his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it'll be apparent to both parties. And to me, that means that he's telling me that God will bring them back together if they're meant to be back together. If the damage has been too great, like it was in my case, then I have to keep living the program day by day, and I have to not create any havoc in my former wife's life. and I've done that now for 14 years, avoided creating havoc in her life. For the first 3.5 years that I was bouncing in and out, and she was pushing buttons, and I was sending emails and nasty grams, as I call them, I was the one that continued to get drunk. When I started putting this program of action into my life, I started living on a different basis. And when I'd get a nasty gram in, my sponsor would tell me, you've got a couple of different buttons. You don't have to hit reply. There's a delete button. And I went, wow. There is a delete button there. Let no alcoholic say that he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect, remind the person you're working with, that his recovery is not dependent upon people. Not dependent on the wife coming back. Not dependent on the family coming back. His recovery is dependent on his relationship with his God. And it says it right there. It's dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We have seen others slip when the family comes back too soon. So you really have to let them know that is not something that's up to you as what we now call a sponsor. That's up to between the person who's in this program, who's gotten through all the way up through the 11 steps, and now he's working with other people. But we're working with a guy, and we need to let him know that whether they come back or not, it's up to God. Because everything's up to God. And he's telling you that he's seen them when they come back too soon, they slip, and sometimes they never come back. Mine never came back, and God bless her. She's got a great new life. Both of you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. Both you and the new man. So instead of me being able to just say, okay, you need to do this, and I'm going to go over and do this. Like I said last week, you've got to be able to follow me around 24 hours a day and see how I live my life. And if I'm not living it on a spiritual basis, then I'm not practicing this program. I am not a saint. I am not going to church on a regular basis. But I am following the dictates that have been put in this book. And my life is better today than I could ever dream. And I've got all kinds of things that are going in the south direction right now. And I know that God's going to catch them before they get too far down, and he's going to turn them north. I just have to believe that. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. And I have made some great mistakes in sobriety because I had a great plan. You know, I used to say that I'd tell my sponsor, hey, I've got a good idea, and he would tell me, pray about it. And then I'd call him and say, I've got a great idea, and he'd say, come over. Normally by the end of those great ideas, he was like, where are you at? I'm in page 62. I'm in selfish and self-centeredness. That's exactly where my great ideas got me, you know. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you'll live in a wonderful world. When working with a man and his family, remember that we're not just working with a man, that we need to be talking to his family also. We need to be helping the family if we can. We need to know as much about the person we're going to be working with to know how we address issues with them. When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. Stay out of their business. Do not take sides. You know, that is not your job. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do, but urge upon a man's family that he has been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. And so what I've told the parents of the kids that I work with, the wives of the guys that I work with, is I'm dealing with a sick person. You've been dealing with a sick person for a long time. You just thought he was weak-willed, and you didn't believe it's an illness. And now this book has shown me I have a threefold illness. The doctor told me about two parts of it, and then Dr. Young had the third part, and when they were brought all together, I had to get over my spiritual malady before I could be physically and mentally healed. You should warn, now that you're talking about to the family, you should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them, not tell them, but show them that he has entered upon a period of growth, and ask them to remember when they are impatient the blessed fact that he's sober. Now, in the book, it talks about, you know, the guy whistling in the wind, you know, ain't it grandma, the wind stopped blowing, woo-woo, I stopped drinking. You know, and if that's all you want in life, is to stop drinking, that's fine. I had a guy used to say all the time, there's no wrong way to stay sober, if that's all you want, is to stay sober. But I wanted something else. I wanted something that I stole for so many years. I wanted peace of mind. And just stopping drinking was not giving me peace of mind. Stopping drinking made me restless, irritable, and discontent. And so I needed to do this, what Bill wrote down, and what this first 100 agreed to. I needed to do this. And at first, when I came in the program and I got sober a little bit, my former wife stopped the divorce. And when I was sober 45 days, I've been drinking 30 years. She'd lived with me for 21. When I was sober for 45 days, when I hadn't had a drink for 45 days, I had not worked this program, she decided that she wanted to celebrate with me and reconcile our relationship by going out and getting drunk together. And I was very happy that she wanted to reconcile, and I was thrilled that if she wanted to get drunk, that was going to be fine by me. But I was really trying not to drink. And so we went out, and she started having some margaritas. I was having iced tea. I was having a great time. For the first time in my life, I was having a great time not drinking. She proceeded to get drunk, and because I wouldn't, she got so damn mad at me when we went home that night, she went into her room, slammed the door, locked it, and called the attorney, and the divorce was back on. And my head was just spinning around going, what in the world is going on? And what did I do the next day? I picked up a bottle of whiskey.
Oh, man.
And I went right back at it. I went right back at it as hard as I could for about another 2 months. And the divorce was on. And you know what? It took me 3.5 years of in and out. Because while the divorce was on and I was in the bottle, I gave away the only thing that mattered to me. I gave away my son. You know, a 5-year-old boy, I gave him away to another man to raise 3 states away. And I gave away an awful lot of other things because I just didn't want to hear any more bitching about my drinking. I just wanted to drink. And then I had a moment of clarity. I came back in the room. I picked up a white chip. People said, you need to get a sponsor. That went over my head. You know, people said, you need to put these steps in your life. I'll just go to meetings and I'll pray and I won't drink. And that didn't work for me. All right, it goes on to say, if you've been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family how that was accomplished. In this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. You never want to be critical of somebody else's family. You want to tell them how I set my wrongs right. And it was one I finally gave up. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of criticism. I know lots of people who got back together. You know, they separated, they didn't get a divorce, the person came in, actually worked a program of recovery, and they were able to get back together. He's talking here about him and Lois and Bob and Ann again. And it goes on to say, at the bottom of the page, assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. And here's, you know, people don't read that and study that, and they decide, well, you know, I haven't been drinking for 6 months, I'm going to go to my sister's wedding and I'm going to hang around after the reception. And it's going to go on to tell us right now that people have said that we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. And their experience shows that that's not necessarily so. Their experience shows back that if they are spiritually fit, you can go where you need to go. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety, would be some place like Greenland Ice Cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Jeez. And they would, too. Ask any woman who sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. Geographical changes. If I move here, if I go there, it'll be different. I mean, all of us know about geographical changes. What winds up happening everywhere I move somewhere or go somewhere? Dang it. There I am. There I am. Okay? No, you can't. Okay? Bill goes on to say, in our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. Every time he went to the asylum, he was locked away from booze. So he didn't drink. Every time he came out, because he didn't have a spiritual answer, Bill picked up a drink. And that had been happening to thousands and thousands and thousands of men and women until the time came where that spiritual experience hit Bill and he realized that what Ebbie had brought him, what Ebbie called religion from the Oxford group, was really a spiritual sense, and that he needed to be able to be in front of alcohol. Okay? If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. All right? So what he's saying, again, is if we're trying to shield ourselves, if we're trying to hide from alcohol, and we're not spiritually fit, we're going to have a worse relapse than ever. This progressive fatal illness that's in my body right now is waiting for me to pick up a drink. And if I do, it's not going to be just to have a drink. It's going to be to have an explosion. And I'll die. So he goes on with the second to last paragraph. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking. And, you know, I started off this whole workshop talking about squiggly lines. The italics are very important. If we have a legitimate reason for being there. If we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties. Now, since I've been sober and since I've been in this program, in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never been to a whoopee party. Because I don't have any reason to be at a whoopee party. I'm still waiting for somebody to tell me what one is anyway, but I'm sure it's some kind of, you know, fun time. The person who's had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. Because if we have a legitimate reason for being there and we're spiritually fit, we can go around places that serve alcohol. In my real estate career, we have conventions, we have all kinds of things. There's some people in my office that know that I'm in recovery, and there's some people that don't. And so I get handed the 2 or 3 drink tickets whenever I go to the convention. And I always go up and get a ginger ale with a piece of lime in it, and everybody thinks that I'm having some kind of drink except my broker and the people who know I'm in recovery. They know I'm having a ginger ale. You know, I have a legitimate reason for being there. My broker has requested me to be there. He requests me to be at our Christmas party. Almost everybody in my office drinks. Not all of them drink to an extreme. A couple of them might be heavy drinkers. I don't know if any of them are alcoholics. I know 4 who are alcoholics. And they all worked right next to me. One of them killed himself 2 years ago, drank himself to death, 17 years in and out of the program, never could do a four step. Another one had a stroke, died 2 years ago. The other one right now is living in a halfway house down on the south part of town. Struggled, just like I did, but never surrendered. And so I can go any of these places. When I was just in Orlando, we had a cancer fundraiser for a real good close friend of mine's son, who's in the program. 7 years, she's from Scotland, 7 years sober, and they had a fundraiser, and it was at a soccer stadium, but the fundraiser was in the bar. When I was in Orlando, I went there to see her and her son because he was in a little bit of a remission time and they had him out of the hospital. They had already left by the time I got there. I'm standing there. I make my donation towards the cancer and I'm looking around and I'm seeing everybody drinking. At that point, I'm spiritually fit because I'm working this program. And I say to myself, I don't know any of these people. Everybody's drinking. They're all encouraging me to go to the bar. What do I need to do? I need to go out and get in my car and leave. And that's exactly what I did. I tell my guys, when you're new in recovery and you have to go to these places, take your own vehicle. Take your cell phone so you can call. Try to go with another recovering alcoholic. These are all ways that you won't get tempted when you're there. But if you're spiritually fit and you have a legitimate reason for being there, there is no reason for you not to be a part of life, because alcohol is all over life. Okay, the last paragraph, it says, you will note that we make an important qualification, therefore ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? And if you answer these questions satisfactorily, which means honestly to yourself, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. But be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start and that your motives in going is thoroughly good. I'm going to repeat that again. But be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you can get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. If you're shaky, you'd better work with another alcoholic instead. And so what they're saying is go anywhere if you're spiritually fit. But if you're not, it's best to be talking to another alcoholic, to be working with another alcoholic. Talking to your sponsor. Because it says, why sit with a long face in places where there is drinking, sighing about the good old days? At the end of my drinking, I do not consider those good old days. I was a chronic, hopeless drunk, and I was at home with the blinds drawn, drinking myself to death. Now, that was not the good old days. The good old days might have been the few times when I started drinking and I would go out to the bars with some friends and we'd laugh and have fun. I always wound up drunk, but I wasn't dying at that time. I crossed the line. If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If it's a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means go along. Let your friends know that you're not to change their habits on your account. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. Everybody that knows me, the people I grew up with, the few that still are alive, everybody who knows me and that goes with me knows that I don't drink. Not all of them know that I'm an alcoholic. Not all of them know that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. They know that alcohol does something to me, it disagrees with me, and I just don't want to drink. I let them know that, you know? And so I don't get offered drinks by people in my office when we go to a Christmas party. They know it just doesn't agree with me. If they assume I'm an alcoholic, good. Maybe that plants a seed to them, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me, who knows? If you do this thoroughly, few people will ask you to drink. While you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. This book, over and over, describes my life. Now you're getting back into the social life of the world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. I got a friend that comes up to my property in Randolph County every year in November to hunt. And he was the one that was the catalyst for me to come up last November. And when I found my brother dead for 3 days, we came up because his brother was getting ready to be released from an alcoholic rehab center after his leg was amputated. And he wanted to know what was going to happen. And I told him, I can't play God, but I know what's going to happen. He's going to get out. He hasn't had a drink in 3 months. He's going to have a pocket full of pain pills. He's going to get a gallon of Gallo, because that's what he liked to drink. And in a couple of weeks, he's probably going to die. He died in 2 days. Just that way. Okay? But when he comes up to my property to hunt for a weekend, he'll bring up like an 18-pack of O'Doul's. Doesn't bother me a bit. And it's always been a running joke for about the past 10 years. He'll always say, Jim, would you like an O'Doul's? And I go, what's the point? And he just laughs, because he knows I'm in here. He knows why. He's glad I'm in here. We're much better friends than when I was drinking. Your job now is to be at a place where you may be in maximum helpfulness to others, so never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Remember on page 77, it talks about our real purpose being of maximum service to God and our fellows. So we're here to be helpful now. So we should never hesitate to go anywhere if we can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. I went to some pretty sordid spots on earth when I was drinking. And I've gone to some real sordid spots on earth to pick up drunks and take them to detox. But I go there, like I always say, with somebody else, and I go there with the proper motive, and I go there spiritually fit. I'm going there to perform service, you know. Now, this is up, and when Bill says it, he says it because some of them did, some of them don't. Back then, a lot of them kept alcohol in their home. And when they brought people into their homes to detox them, they would detox them down with a little bit of alcohol. I do not recommend that. I don't recommend giving a shaking alcoholic a drink. I don't know what else they've got in their system. You know, there's just too many painkillers out there that they won't tell you that they're taking, and I don't want to be the one responsible. So I don't keep alcohol in my home. And it's not because I'm worried about me drinking it. Most people who come to my home either bring their own or don't drink. You know, like the guy who brings the O'Doul's. We often need to carry green recruits through a severe hangover. This is what they were doing in 39. Some of us still serve it to our friends provided they are not alcoholic. But some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. I'm one of those. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves. Now, I don't serve it to green recruits. I don't serve it to guys who just got out of detox and are still shaking. They're in detox to detox. When they get out, they need to get into the program and get into the action of the steps. They don't need a sip here and there. All that does is set off the physical craving again, and it's back on another round. But it does say that they're not telling you you have to do it one way or another. They're giving you an option. We are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. It's not helpful to me. It's not helpful to the institution. It's not helpful to other people. People drink. There are people that can drink and have a couple drinks and enjoy themselves, have a couple glasses of wine. I know people who can do that. I'm not one of them. And so I don't downgrade and I don't say that wineries should be banned or this should be that. That's none of my business. My business is to keep myself sober and to help a new person achieve sobriety through these steps. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. So we're not running around screaming against alcohol. Back in the third step, we found out that alcohol was just a symptom of an alcoholic's disease. The selfish and self-centeredness, over and over. Our own selfish and self-centeredness was our real problem, was the root of our problem. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in a thousand likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. And I liken this to reformed smokers. Oh, you ought to quit. You know, they've been smoking 20 years. Now they're quit. They're a week without a cigarette. Oh, you ought to quit smoking. You ought to quit smoking. And it's like, go away. I will quit smoking when God and I work the 12 steps on my nicotine problem. I have not decided to quit smoking. My sponsor of 28 years sober, 50 years a smoker, decided 30 days ago that he didn't want to smoke anymore. He's having real trouble breathing, and he just said, I'm done. And he took the book, and he went through the 12 steps, and he hadn't had a cigarette in 30 days. And I am so proud of that man. I really am.
Yeah.
I really am.
That's great.
All right, it goes on. Someday we hope the Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to have a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem, but we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness and hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anyone, anybody, or anything. We have to. Now that right there, with the doctor's opinion, is the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next three chapters were to the wives, to the family afterwards, and to the employers. And so this book in 1939 was being mailed out. Sometimes a wife would write to New York, and she would read the chapter to the wives, and then, you know, maybe leave this book laying around for her husband to find. The chapter to the wives was written by Bill Wilson. A lot of people thought it was written by Lois. Bill gave Ann Smith the first opportunity to write it, and when she said she didn't want to write it, Bill said, well, I'll write it. And Lois said, no, I'll write it. And Bill said, no, the publisher wants it to flow, you know, just like it's been flowing, so I need to write it. And Lois remembers, and in the Lois Wilson story, When Love Is Not Enough, Lois carried her resentment the rest of her life that she didn't get to write that chapter. The whole chapter about To the Wives is about forgiveness. All right? Now, I didn't know we were going to end so early, and so we're probably not going to have a second hour today, but what I want to do is, and this is the only time I think I'm going to do this. Matter of fact, I know it's the only time I'm going to do it, because like I said, we were just going to be studying the history and up to the 12 steps. I think if you want to read To the Wives, To the Family Afterwards, and To the Employers, that's great. A Vision for You is a fantastic chapter, but you can never get A Vision for You if you haven't done the program of action. And in the 12 and 12, which Bill wrote 13 years later, I'm going to read one little thing right here. AA's, it's on page 107, you don't have it, but I don't think anybody brought it, but AA's manner of making ready to receive this gift, the gift of peace of mind and of tolerance, of honesty, unselfishness, and love, lies in the practice of the 12 steps of our program. So let's consider briefly what we've been trying to do up to this point. Step 1 showed us an amazing paradox. We found that we were totally unable to be rid of the alcohol obsession until we first admitted that we were powerless over it. In step 2, we saw that since we could not restore ourselves to sanity, some higher power must necessarily do so if we were to survive. Consequently, in step 3, we turned our will and our lives, our thoughts and our actions, over to the care of God as we understood Him. For the time being, we who were atheists or agnostic discovered that our own group, or AA as a whole, would suffice as a higher power. Beginning with step 4, we commenced to search out the things in ourselves for which has brought us to physical, moral, and spiritual bankruptcy. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, not anybody else. Looking at step five, we decided that an inventory taken alone wouldn't be enough. We knew that we'd have to quit the deadly business of living alone with our conflicts and in honesty confide these to God and to another human being. At step six, many of us balked for the practical reason that we did not wish to have all our defects of characters removed because we still love them, some of them, too much. I would have to say there's still some that I care about affectionately. I don't love them anymore. But an awful lot of them I don't want, and I want them gone. And I think God takes away those ones that we need taken away each day when we ask Him. You know, I'm not a greedy person. I was when I came in here. Yet we knew we had to make a settlement with the fundamental principles of step six. So we decided that while we still had some flaws of character that we could not yet relinquish, we ought nevertheless to quit our stubborn, rebellious hanging on to them. We said to ourselves, this I cannot do today, perhaps, but I can stop crying out, no, never. And so one of the things that's been hammered into me is never say never, because you just don't know what God's got in store. Then in step seven, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings such as He could or would under the conditions of the day we ask. Each day. We're living this program day by day, so each day we have to ask. And how are we living? What are the conditions that we're asking? In step eight, we continued our house cleaning, for we saw that we were not only in conflict with ourselves, but also with people and situations in the world in which we lived. We had to begin to make our peace, and so we listed the people we had harmed and became willing to set things right. We followed this up in step nine by making direct amends to those concerned, except when it would injure them or other people. Now, I have had plenty of sponsees say, well, if I go make that amend, I'm going to get harmed. And I'm like, really? You're going to go avoid paying back somebody you owe money because you're going to get harmed? How are you going to get harmed? And I use the example that, you know, well, you know, I don't want to go give them my money. And I always look at them and shake my head and I go, it's not your money. It's their money. You owe it to them. You took it from them. Go pay it back. Except when to injure them or other people. By this time at step 10, we had begun to get a basis for daily living and we keenly realized that we would need to continue taking personal inventory and that when we were wrong, we ought to promptly admit it. In step 11, we saw that if a higher power had restored us to sanity and it enabled us to live with some peace of mind in a sorely troubled world, then such a higher power was worth knowing better by direct contact as possible. The persistent use of meditation and prayer, we found, did open the channel so that where there had been a trickle, there was now a river which led to sure power and safe guidance from God as we were increasingly better to understand Him. You know, stay close to God and do His work well. That's steps 11 and 12. So practicing these steps, we had a spiritual awakening about which, finally, there was no question. Looking at those who were only beginning and still doubted themselves, the rest of us were able to see the change settling in. From great numbers of experience, we could predict that the doubter who still claimed that he hadn't got the spiritual angle, who still considered his well-loved AA group his higher power, would presently love God and call Him by name. All right? And then this last paragraph here. Now, what about the rest of the 12th step? The wonderful energy it releases and the eager action by which it carries our message to the next suffering alcoholic and which finally translates the 12 steps into action upon all our affairs is the payoff, the magnificent reality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that concludes our little big book study. And I'm really glad everybody's been here.